Blog Talk Radio.
May I say something to you to give you a true knowledge of yourself and life so that the same glory and...
Here we are. Here we are. Yeah. This one right here is for the people.
Egyptian mummies and a flag of a moon, and can't find food for the starving dummies. Pay no mind to the youth, cause it's not like the future depends on it. But save the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee them a make big money. This is how the media pillages on TV, the picture is establishes the villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a car, keep on and all of a sudden you are set at Indiana Jones. And I see all the gold and see all the scrolls and even the bird bones. Some of the worst paparazzis I've ever seen and I've ever known. Put the words on this place that the world can see and it's all that will ever show. So the ones in the west will never move east and feel like a free at home. Get tricked by the beast, but the way them are gonna flee when the monster is fully grown. Salamonic lineage where them feet can defeat and them could have never clone. A spiritual DNA that lives in my soul and I will forever own, Lord.
Yeah. Sabali, that's patience. That's what the old folks told me. Can you give a that? Discovering the world before this world. A world buried in time. Uncovered with rhyme. No realer.
We born not knowing, are we born knowing all? We growing wiser, are we just growing tall? Can you read thoughts? Can you read palms? Can you predict the future? Can you see storms coming? The earth was static, you went too far, you would fall off. Now the earth is round, if the shape change again, everybody would have thought lost. The average man can't prove of most of the things that he chooses to seek of. And still run research and find out the roots of the truth that you seek of. Scholars teach in universities and claim that they're smart and cunning. Tell them find a cure when we sneeze and that's when their nose starts running. And the wrist gets fixed up when we get cut. Wanna heal them broken bones in the bush with the wet mud. Can you read signs? Can you read stars? Can you make peace? Can you fight war? Can you milk cows? Even though you drive cars, can you survive against all odds now?
It's crazy. When you feed people the truth, you don't know how they're gonna react. You're scared of wrongdoers. People that's just ignorant. They're scared of the truth. For now, who wrote the Bible? Who wrote the Quran? And was it a lightning storm that gave birth to the earth and then dinosaurs were born? Who made up words? Who made up numbers? And what kind of spell is mankind under? Everything on the planet we preserve and can it. Microwave it and try it, no matter what, we'll survive it. What's you? What's man? What's human? Anything along the land we consuming. Eating, deleting, ruining.
trying to get paper. Gotta have land, gotta have acres. So I can sit back like Jack Nicholson, watch niggas play the game like the Lakers. In a world full of 52 fakers, gypsies, seances, mystical prayers. You superstitious, so over your shoulders, make a wish for the day, cuz like somebody got a doll of me. Sticking needles in my artery, but I can't feel it. Sometimes it's like part of me, but I got a real big spirit. I'm fearless. Don't you try to grab hold of my soul. It's like a military soldier, 10, 7 years old. I held real dead bodies in my arms, felt their body turn cold. Oh, why are we born in the first place if this is how we gotta go? Dang. To all the wisdom and knowledge seekers of the world. Sabali. Patience. Yeah.
Rally round the red. When you dive, churches, I'll knock you through Sunday and be waiting for you on Monday. You're too young to have seen the sights of Esther Manning and Pappy about Dolomite.
Planet Earth was my place of birth, born to be the sole controller of the universe. Besides the part of the map, I hit first. Any environment I can adapt. When it gets worse, the rough gets going, the going gets rough. When I start blowing the mic, mic bust. The next day to shake from the power I generate. People in Cali used to think it was earthquakes. Cause times is hard on the boulevard. So I fold guard and never get scarred. I'm scarred, but it seems like I'm locked in hell. Looking over the edge, but the R never fell. A trip to slip, cause my knife got gripped. Stand on my own 2 feet and come equipped. Any stage I'm seen on, a mic I fiend on. I stand alone and need nothing to lean on. Going for self with a long way to go. So much to say, but I still flow slow. I come correct and I won't look back. Cause it ain't where you're from, it's where you're at. Even the
nobody smiling. Nobody smiling. Nobody smiling.
I learn to relax in my room and escape from New York and return through the wound of the world as a thought. Thinking how hard it was to be born. Me being queen with no physical form. Playing yourself with one destination to reach the best part of life's creation. 9 months later, a job well done. Make way, cause here I come. Since I made it this far, I can't stop now. There's a will and a way, and I got the know-how to be all I can be and more. And see all the ends to see before. I'm called to go back to the essence. It's a lot to learn, so I study my lessons. I thought the ghetto was the worst that can happen to me. I'm glad I listened when my father was rapping to me. Cause back in the days, they lived in caves. Exiled from the original man and strayed away. Now that's what I call hard times. I'd rather be here to exercise the mind. Then I take the thought around the world twice. From knowledge to form, back to knowledge precise. Across the desert, that's hot as the Arabian. But they couldn't cave me in, cause I'm the Asian. Reaching for the city of Mecca, visit Medina. Visions of Nefertiti, then I seen her. Mind keeps traveling, I'll be back after. I stop and think about the brothers and sisters in Africa. Return the doors through the eye of a needle. For miles I fought and I just brought the people. Under the dark skies, on the dark side. Not only there, but right here in the park side. So now is the time for us to react. Take a trip through the mind and when you get back, understand your third eye, I seen all of that. It ain't where you're from, it's where you're at. Even the
nobody's smiling. Nobody's smiling.
Even though.
Nobody's smiling. Nobody's smiling.
No more props, I want property in every borough. Nobody's stopping me because of several rhymes I make. Give me real estate for me to own. Whatever I bless, a microphone. 007 is back and relaxing. On point and reacting and ready for action. I'm so low key that you might not see me. Incognito and taking it easy. Why just kept going to hush hush in front of a crowd? I get loud as a bum rush for calm. Keep a low pro and play the background. Over the whack rapper, put the mic back down. So rip it, break it in half, go ahead and slam it. Cause when it's time to build, I'm a mechanical bonding, amending, attaching and blending. So many solos, there is no ending. People in my neighborhood, they know I'm good. From London to Hollywood, wherever I stood. Footprints remain on stage ever since. Sidewalks and streets, I leave fossils. And then, when I had sex, I left my name on next. My trademark was left throughout the project. I used to get rich when I played CeeLo. When I roll 4, 5, 6, they go keto. So I collect my cash and slide. I got my back, my guns on my side. It shouldn't have to be like that. I guess it ain't where you're from, it's where you're at. Even the
nobody smiling. Nobody smiling.
I'm from the
I want you to stay in school and be cool. If you fight, you're going to have to answer to Dolomite.
What's that?
Like
some old geek guy, something.
This is Petty Officer.
Black power, black power. We see our boards are being messed with, but we're going to continue on with our broadcast. Calling every night, every Tuesday night. Calling every Tuesday night, same black place, same black time, at 845-277-9266. Again, that's 845-277-9266. This is the People's Radio, so make sure y'all press the number one to participate. Tonight's topic, who said there were leaders? Part two. We got to run it back from last week, but we're going to do a part two. So we're going to go ahead and open up our lines today for the People's Political Party National Chairman and our National Minister of Defense. Can y'all hear me, comrades?
Right on. Black power. The whole rule. What's up? Straight up. Yeah, we're gonna pick up where we left off. Can y'all hear me? Can y'all hear me?
Black power, I can hear you loud and clear, Chair.
Okay, right on. Yeah, and look, we just want to let you know for those who are listening, listeners. As usual, you know, when certain individuals and persons within the black community or the collective of America or even the diaspora internationally gets around to the point of understanding that goes beyond the prescribed parameters to its various institutions, you know, set out for those, you know, so-called black persons in terms of their intellectual capacity or their ability to think. When it goes beyond that, you know, there's some problems, you know, it's problematic. After all, it is what it is. These conditions where black people find themselves in the situation, you know, where it's, you know, survival. And in the midst of a dominant group, you know, that has the type of psychology, you know, where it breeds a survival of the fittest mentality, which is known in these circles as social Darwinism, where the white dominant group seeks to maintain constant control of the state of things, of the order, the pecking order. Or, you know, it was known as the status quo to some of us, you know, to keep the structure the same. And so, you know, when a brother or sister comes along and is able to have the potential to get the people to begin to to think in the manner of dismantling what in essence is, you know, a master-slave relationship, there's problems. And so in various forms of communication, whatnot, book, magazine, pamphlet, talk show, whatever, visual, audio, which is what this is, the state, you know, will seek to intercede, make it difficult or even prevent the word from getting out, you know, a particular word that may be considered threatening to the social order. And so this is a radio show that doesn't prescribe to the usual standard of what may be considered so-called black radio, even though on the face of it, there may be hosts or producers who may have topics or discussions that may be considered controversial, you know, or a bit frisky, you know, and give the perception of radicalism or what have you. And there's, you know, of course, was known as the glass ceiling, or how far one's leech extends out, you know, or one knowing his limitations due to the power structure, you know. But here we make the attempt to think outside the box, to go beyond the usual bullshit, you know, the usual storyline, you know, where the black skin white mask, which is actually the title of a book that was written by a great revolutionary and psychiatrist, Frantz Fanon, who played a valuable role in the Algerian struggle for liberation out from underneath the imperialist whims or clutches of the French, confiscated Northern Africa as a colonial entity, you know, as an as a one of the European empires in the 20th century. And so, you know, like I say, we just want to, you know, let the viewers know that any type of difficulties we may have may not necessarily be our own doing. And as we've experienced it before. And so in continuing this discussion, who said there were black leaders, we feel that we've at least set the tone that unseen forces have been behind the construction or fabrication of black leadership. You know, which is why in schools, the average child, teenager, what have you, is familiar with the usual names, you know, that have been taught to us. You know, Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, A. Philip Randolph, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, and Mary Church Terrell, which is maybe one of the lesser known, you know, black figures. And this is not saying this is, you know, this is not, you know, being said in a mocking sense. It is what it is. You know, when you can control the narrative of a group of people whose ancestors were forced to build the capitalist economy into what it is today, contrary to the intellectual masturbation, as I've heard, you know, before, that I adopt to using the farce about, you know, one who pulled themselves up by the bootstraps, or who worked hard and who toiled and worked hard to make this country great for what it is, and the working class people who built America. We know that is bullshit. And those of us who have an ounce of sense to be able to think for ourselves, to take the muzzle off. And so this effort to fabricate leadership for the future on the part of the white ruling class families, such as the Carnegie, Harriman, Rockefeller, DuPont, Morgans, Vanderbilts, and several other lesser-known white wealthy families who have accumulated massive sums of wealth of those who they dominate in the economic and political realm, you know. And so we're up to the point in the approaching the Jim Crow era, off of the hills of the 1910s, 20s, where there were several persons who were instrumental in establishing some type of imagery, for black people to model themselves after in terms of the type of philosophy or ideology that one would try to embrace in order to end the misery of the conditions of the black collective masses of the black people here in this country. And that has pretty much been the gist of it when it comes to a type of ideology which we have been, led to embrace what is referred to as civil rights, which from day one, it was never about our civil rights in this country. It has always been about our human rights as a group of people. And no civil right could ever trump the human right to live and exist on this planet as a human being, as a specific type of human being who just happened to have dark pigments or various shades of brown with a pigmentation that some of us would know as melanin. And so that is the real struggle, the true struggle, the natural struggle for people who have found themselves under the conditions of the dominant group, which has the power of authority to rule and dominate us, to determine how we even live, actually, which is what Jim Crow was all about, where the whites had set themselves up laws that would protect their whole person, property, interests, and their position within society. And so at some point it would become natural that there would be some type of blowback or some type of resistance that would challenge that. And so the challenge that this type of resistance could reach a maximum point to where it would lead to the same results that had been achieved by the white ruling class hypocrites who owned slaves on one end and were declaring that they were being oppressed by the King of England on the other end, which led them to draft the Declaration of Independence. And so we say today that we concur, and now it's the time of the descendants of those who have benefited, who have profited, to recognize that they're on the hot seat, so to speak, and that we have the right to the same thought process, same attitude even, that their bastard ancestors had when they were claiming they were being oppressed. And so in the tens and the 20s, the figures that you had were A. Philip Randolph, Alain Locke, W.E.B. Du Bois, for the most part, and the founding, of course, before that, in the first decade of the 20th century, the establishment of the what is referred to as the Boule, led chiefly by one Henry Minton and a select group of individuals who, according to them, had black mentalities the old saying about birds of the same feather flock together. And so they had carved out for themselves a little neat little niche for themselves, and began to select other individuals. And one of those individuals was W.E.B. Du Bois, who we are told went on to found the NAACP. And a thorough investigation of it tells us more than we've been led to believe through the orthodox understanding of how the NAACP was founded. Now, there may be those who are listening who may feel some type of way. Of what I'm attempting to bring across here, but it is what it is, and if it has something to do with leadership, and it is always the right of the followers to ask questions, even take a critique of their leadership. Examine the leadership, whether or not this leadership is genuine leadership, no strings attached, or leadership that has been put in a position to where they have to operate with restraints. This is the strategy on the part of the white ruling class, as I said, because of point at some time in nature that the oppressed black masses of America would rise up and alleviate their problems the best way they know how. And a lot of us are afraid to embrace the term revolutionary. That term appears to be problematic, or there's a monopoly placed on it when it comes to Europeans, not only in the history of America, but in other parts of the world. The term has been embraced fully in the countries of Russia, Germany, Italy, where the class contradictions had become exposed, and the white dominant few over the many, and they had the clash, which is what led to the French Revolution. And this is embraced in the history of Europeans, and Europeans can embrace that with ease. Problematic when it's black and brown people who are seeking the same path to alleviate their problems. Okay, and so this is why, for the most part, these entities that have come about being the boule, and that may be a term that some of us may be familiar with. And just for the simple fact that, you know, some of us are college educated, we have second, third, fourth generation. And in the collegiate world, the term is embraced in a rather, you know, good image or context. But according to Lawrence Otis Graham, who is a member of the Boule, out of his own mouth, in a book that he wrote called Our Kind of People, which we will make several references to, he himself says that if you think that the boule is just the boule in terms of what the average college person believes, then you're sadly mistaken. And he didn't make that statement or that comment by coincidence. It's just a subtle way of saying that the boule is bigger than what you think it is. apart from the fraternities, even though its name of Sigma Pi Phi is fraternal. And this is the organizational fraternity of all fraternities. And for the past over 100 years, the average person or figure who has made history within this country, the first black governor of Virginia and whatnot, first president or mayor or black politician, first black CEO of, for instance, American Express, Kenneth Chenault, and a whole other host of other black figures who have made history that our boys and girls have been told that they should model themselves after, are and were members of the Boule, and their connections with the white ruling class families, and particularly the Rockefellers. And this is no coincidence. It's just like having a Rolodex of names, and whatever the white ruling class wants to make history or want to impress upon the black masses of the people in this country, or the masses of black people in this country want to impress upon them in the sense of getting them to believe that black people have made these incredible strides as opposed to slavery, Reconstruction, Jim Crow, even on into the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. It is at any moment, at any time, they can always make history using the corporate control owned and ran media to keep black people in the position of subservience, to prevent them from elevating their conscience to the point of revolutionary. Liberalism, activism, radicalism, militancy in the highest stage of becoming a revolutionary. We believe that the highest type of black man in this country can be a revolutionary, contrary to Colin Powell, Clarence Thomas, and even the great Barack Obama. We believe so because neither one of those individuals would have a vested interest in altering the class structure or the pyramidal structure of America, because the old saying, why cut off the hand that's feeding you, in the terms of a class, cliquish mentality where you have internalized the classism that the whites have had to deal with for several centuries, and now modeling your group, your style of thought, your philosophy, or your cup of tea on what is known as the skull and bones, as I mentioned in the first part. And this legacy of controlling the black masses through various forms of illusions, deception, misinformation, and disinformation in blackface. And so in the midst of that came along a bold black man from the Caribbean named Marcus Messiah Garvey. And Garvey had become a thorn in the side of members of the Boule, the Negro Intelligentsia, whom W.E.B. Du Bois referred to as the Talented Ten. And Du Bois reached that conclusion based on the collective masses of black people in this country. And he figured that 10% of us would gain some type of intellectual capacity to compete with the Europeans in terms of philosophical thought. And so that is how that term was coined as the Talented Ten. Now, at first glance, on the surface, This appears to be a great thing, and that those of us who would aspire to become part of the Taliban tent, you know, would go on to great things. In any social movement, in any revolutionary struggle, there's always the petty bourgeoisie intellectuals who more times than not have become the leadership of the struggle. And this is historic. And so the state realizing that, again, the state was able to cut it off at the pass, so to speak. And if there was going to be one, then it should be shaped by those who run the state machinery. The property owners, the stakeholders, the stockholders, those who own the shares and the companies and the corporations. Beginning with America, which is a corporation, which is incorporated as a corporate entity in what is now the District of Columbia. And it is the only region or jurisdictional land that is not as referred to as a state because of the corporate entity, you know, that this American government became legitimized. And so due to the potential for toppling the state, again, you know, they were able to create something to keep the rest of us at bay. And Garvey, his ideology, his philosophy was based on studying the same entities that accumulated massive capital. And Garvey realized that some people say that you fight fire with fire. Best way to fight fire is with water. And so this is what Garvey began to realize because they understood the Rockefellers, the Oppenheimers, the Rothschilds, and all these other families. And so he developed a philosophy of nationalism, you know, self-determination. If the whites were able to have it and do it, then it wasn't impossible for black people to achieve the same, so much so in the sense the repatriation to Africa, Africa being our homeland, our original homeland, and we are still a displaced nation of people for those who don't fully understand that. We've never been Americans, and we won't ever be Americans because certain criteria that doesn't fit due to who we are being the descendants of African people. Our lot has always been to be the part of the labor force, the beast of burden. And when slavery, physical slavery, was put down, we became a surplus class, a surplus group of people, which means that your work had become valueless collectively. And so this is the cornerstone of the present conditions of black people today. And this is also the cornerstone that will lead black people into a revolutionary type mentality. But along the way, a vicious struggle to survive. In the meantime, survival programs such as that was instituted by the Black Panther Party and which was also hijacked by the state, as a matter of fact, impending revolution. And so there are those who are out here in America today who understand that. But we've had the struggle with this historical legacy of leadership. And so once again, Garvey's ideology had began to make some incredible strides as a organization, a Universal Negro Improvement Association, which reaches far as you know, Great Britain and around the world. And so in the midst of that, A. Philip Randolph, W.E.B. Du Bois, and several others, Alain Locke, at some point in time, were opposed to Garvey's ideology. And not only were they opposed to Garvey's ideology, but there's something to the effect that there was even a letter drafted by this group and forwarded to the United States government, which pretty much declared Garvey in so many ways or verbatim a nuisance or a threat to the structure of things. And this is what became part of the vendetta against Marcus Garvey through the arm of the United States, referred to as the FBI, which was instituted in the director, J. Edgar Hoover. If it was not J. Edgar Hoover's first operation, of course, it was among his earliest operations to take down Marcus Garvey. And so the UNIA was infiltrated, and, of course, somebody who looked like Garvey. And this agent had a code known as Agent 800. And this is how they were able to set Garvey up on trumped up charges about mail fraud. And there's even those today, the Negro intellectuals today who are who hold steadfast to the Europeans' account, even today, you know, because that's their purpose, you know, to keep Garvey from resurrecting in the minds of the present population today. And so with that clearing the way, you know, the Negro intelligentsia, as some call them, have been able to implement their brand of relief or seeking civil, some type of civil codes to alleviate the problems of black people. There were other individuals, other persons during that same period. And one of these was Cyril Briggs, who founded what is referred to as the Black African Blood Brotherhood. Briggs' organization was pretty much militant organization due to the conditions. Briggs had become quite threatening to a certain extent. He had embraced communism and socialism, and this is what put him and Marcus Garvey at odds. In the meantime, the element that became shaped as the civil rights leadership headed by A. Philip Randolph in the first March on Washington were able to exploit these contradictions between Garvey and Briggs. A number of individuals, William Trotter, who was also instrumental in what we're told in helping the evolution of the NAACP. Of course, there's the board of directors of the NAACP. The face of it is those who are out there in the midst of these movements, these protests and demonstrations. And of course, we know that board of directors has always determined the direction in which that organization was going to go or influence its policies or ideology. And so this is why there's times where Those of us who understand may notice certain discrepancies, or what some of us may feel is funny vibes, or these unusual patterns or abnormal thought processes where you have a gaping wound and someone's trying to apply a Band-Aid. And Garvey had recognized this in Du Bois. And he had commented that there was something strange about Du Bois, that something was going on with him, that something wasn't right. And he had hit it right on the head. In the meantime, Du Bois could claim Pan-Africanism, sort of a black Philadelphia, the Negro movement. Also during that period in the 20s and the 30s, you had what's referred to as the Harlem Renaissance. And this Harlem Renaissance was this thing about black pride, the black arts, music, poetry, things of that nature. And of course, you know, the jazz era, the jazz greats who were able to make incredible inroads during those periods and during those times, and even in some instances, some gangsters, such as Bumpy Johnson. There's a movie that was made in reference to Bumpy Johnson where Lawrence Fishburne plays Bumpy. Okay. All of that's contemporary, and a lot of these poets, writers, they were able to express themselves in terms of this new Negro movement, which is what it was referred to. And this new Negro movement was named after an anthology, you know, that was written by Alain Locke. And Alain Locke, as I stated in the first part, was the first Rhodes Scholar. And the Rhodes Scholarship was named after Cecil Rhodes, the British magnate who exploited the diamond mines of South Africa and had gotten, like some of us understand, filthy rich. And he had poured his wealth into a series of seven wheels. And those wheels were designed specifically, as according to him, was to win back the American portion of the British Empire. And in the midst of that, he developed what's referred to as the Rhodes Scholarship, and that the Rhodes Scholarship was pretty much used for those who would participate in the reconfiscation of America. And so Alain Locke had become the first Negro Rhodes Scholar. And the shoe fits, wear it, and it fits well. And now we understand why Alain Locke was opposed to Marcus Garvey, because Marcus Garvey was opposed to the same forces that Alain Locke, in essence, had to work for due to him receiving the Rhodes Scholarship. And so this new Negro movement, on the face of it, had gained a lot of popularity. Some of the notable persons who had came out of it, Compte Cullen, James Weldon Johnson, certain individuals. There was a movie that was made called The Great Debaters. And that movie was, in essence, a highlight of the Harlem Renaissance, to where these young black intellectuals debated the best that the white collegiate world had to offer. And so, as a matter of fact, Garvey's role in the Harlem Renaissance was very vital. It was Garvey who had set up the spaces, or space where they could go and hold what we now refer to as spoken word. And he's given little credit by the modern Boulé types, modern black intellectuals who write of the Harlem Renaissance. And so, you know, that is the opposition. And then tensions on are to keep the status quo as it is today. And so when we move into the 40s and the 50s, one individual that comes to mind was known as Vernon Johns. As Garvey was deported from the river in New Orleans. And, you know, that problem had been solved on the part of the state. Type of militancy or the type of black nationalism hadn't completely died. And one of these was Vernon Johns. Vernon Johns was the minister of the now famous Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, who had preceded the person who would become famously known as Martin Luther King. Vernon Johns' militancy became problematic because Vernon Johns had believed that he had also had to meet fire with water, that this passivity, this passive type of mentality was no good for people who were playing hardball. And so black people had better start playing hardball and quit playing softball. And so due to Vernon Johns' militancy, Vernon Johns had to be removed from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in the South because he was stirring up trouble. Some of us may have heard of Rockin' the Boat. And there was a movie that was made about him by the ex-NBA basketball player, Hall of Famer Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who himself, when he was a young basketball player in the 60s, had began to develop some type of understanding himself as a so-called famous wealthy athlete. And his chance encounter with several notable other black figures like Jim Brown and other individuals, where they had sat down to discuss and meet what could they do, what part or what role could they play in the so-called civil rights struggle. Another individual that had became problematic was Paul Robeson. And Paul Robeson was, of course, a theater actor who was fluent in a number of languages, and he spoke vehemently, and he spoke with a strong voice. And of course, his international appeal also began to take notice. And these are the individuals who black people should have been trying to embrace more and more and more, because after Garvey, like I said, it hadn't totally died down. It was a huge hit that our people had took during that time. And also, along with Vernon Johns, Paul Robeson, there was also Adam Clayton Powell. And Adam Clayton Powell had pretty much come on the heels of Garvey in Harlem. And he had become a state senator. And Adam Clayton Powell's philosophy was also considered to be radical and militant. And he had learned the game of politics, and he had become very influential in his hometown, in the borough of Harlem particularly. And so, of course, the state were always looking for a string to pull to deal with these individuals. And so Adam Clayton Powell, this is the politician whom Malcolm X used to speak of often. And he would put Adam Clayton Powell in proper perspective in dealing with the state, and how Adam Clayton Powell would you know, in so many ways, he was exposed to contradictions of, you know, claiming that we lived in a democracy and that, you know, black people had the same constitutional rights, you know, as the whites. And yet constantly kept proving, exposing these contradictions. And the more and more that he did, you see a lot of whites, a lot of liberal whites, you know, began to, you know, embrace Adam Clayton Powell, even to the point where you had certain forces who would align himself with Adam Clayton Powell. And so he just kept, like I said, you know, proving these contradictions. And this is what Malcolm X was able to, you know, come on the heels of Adam Clayton Powell. The gangster who had come up in the Midwest in the 40s and the 50s, known as Malcolm Little, became transformed when he was in prison. He had a brother, an older brother, who was a Muslim, and he was introduced to the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad. He became known as Malcolm X. And, of course, he had adapted the X as the unknown because he said that we didn't know our true and original names and that, therefore, the X was in his place. And that is how he became known as Malcolm X. In the meantime, Martin Luther King had developed into this great minister who was trained or instructed or guided by one Bayard Rustin. And Bayard Rustin was a Rockefeller man, and he figured he'd, you know, give this philosophy to Dr. King based on Gandhiism. And I had mentioned that somewhat in the first part of this topic. And so by that time, King had replaced Vernon Johns at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, and had gone on to become the face or the nucleus of what's referred to as Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Many people are led to believe that the Southern Christian Leadership Conference began in Atlanta, Georgia, but contrary to that fiction, the SCLC was actually began with the initial meeting or his formation, the setup, which in the city of New Orleans, at the behest of the Currier family. The Currier family, of course, was a wealthy family, and they had put up several hundred thousands of dollars and had called a meeting with the Negro intelligentsia, who had come right out of the Boule, and the so-called intellectual world. And that meeting was the initiatory point for how to continue the process of the structured black leadership that began with Booker T. Washington. The conditions had heightened due to the contradictions of the past, thanks to Vernon Johns, Paul Robeson, Adam Clayton Powell, and, of course, the great Malcolm X. And so the Currier family had this idea to, you know, gather what had been projected onto the black struggling masses, the black displaced masses, the black economically disenfranchised masses, which led to inner city crime, segregated with no economic infrastructure, while at the same time paying taxes to Caesar with no representation. And that became one of the slogans in the demonstrations and the protests, where the men and the women, the taxpayers, which came off the heels of the sharecropping. And so they developed the slogan of taxation without representation. And you will see, you know, these old black and white photos and pictures, these historical archives of the civil rights movement. You know, the brothers wearing the signs with the chain or what have you around it over their necks and in front of them. And one of the other signs was, of course, at some point, would have to begin to let the country know that I am a man. And these were ideologies, these were strategies and tactics and psychology to generate some type of thing amongst themselves to where they can gain the respect of the white dominant group for being men. And so the SCLC was formed and moved and came out of Atlanta, and that is how the SCLC was created. Martin Luther King, Ralph Abernathy, who had taken over from King upon King's assassination. In the meantime, there was also point where the black masses had begun to boil over, and a lot of these things that were taking place in the so-called inner cities in the South, in certain cities like South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, and of course New Orleans, the Southern Belt, that now the Republic of New Africa declares that black people have the rightful ownership of being the ones who materialized land, who built the infrastructure of this country. Therefore, the Republic of New Africa, featuring the Southern Belt, heading eastward. And so it is this pocket here that a lot of frustration was brewing. Of course, the era also of the Renaissance, World War One, this great migration that had taken place from the South to the North and to the Midwest and the cities of Chicago and Detroit. And so action that was brewing. And so there was a march where the people were organizing themselves to convene in Washington, D.C. And according to Malcolm X, the powers that be had given instruction to those who were projected as the leaders to get ahead of this march on Washington. And so this is how the march on Washington came to be, and that according to Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, A. Philip Randolph, and all those other individuals had become the face of it, and it was shaped through that based on the civil rights ideology. In the midst of that, such individuals from the Rockefeller family, Nelson Rockefeller, in his bid for the presidency, and he had been the governor of New York. And these, you know, these unseen forces who, let's say, you know, were the leading families, as I had mentioned earlier. Okay, and so in the midst of all of this taking place, you have this march on Washington to where King, you see the video where King's standing there and he's giving this speech. Okay, now Malcolm X had been trying to warn us at the time that this force that Garvey had talked about when he had spoke of Du Bois. And so Malcolm had began to refer to this small clique as the Big Six. This is what later on was realized by brothers who had begun to do the research in our day and time. And so in some of his speeches, Malcolm, would speak of was known as the Big Six. And of course, A. Philip Randolph, Martin Luther King, and other individuals that belonged to that group. And he had explained how financial support, and that the civil rights movement was being steered by these unseen forces. Even at some point when the Black Panther Party had come onto the scene, Eldridge Cleaver, who was the Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party, had even said himself there were these forces that operated behind the scenes, even to the point where the so-called rioting, these forces that were operating behind the scenes that were controlling the atmosphere, due to the threatening nature of a masses of displaced people whose frustration level had reached an apex. And of course, this is also during the time of the Vietnam War, so America had a number of issues on the burner. And so this is why some of the elders still to this day believe that was the time, which is what led to Bobby Seale's titling his book "Seize the Time," that there will come a moment, which is what David Walker had said 130 years prior, that there would come a moment in time where the slave master would get caught with his pants down, and the slave, it'd be his time, to make his move to sever his relationship with his slave master and gain his independence, and Malcolm was asked about this social change, this revolutionary transformation of society, and he had told the reporter outright that the price of freedom is debt. And these are the things that alarmed the state, the types of statements that Malcolm X were making. Now, in the midst of this, there was also the great Robert Williams, who had been at home in South Carolina. Robert Williams was a ex-war vet, so he had learned various techniques and skills by being in the military. And Robert Williams had taken his skills and put them to good use in his neck of the woods. There were several cases of incidences where the Kennedys refused to bring in the National Guard until a European was murdered. One of the so-called good whites were murdered, and then Kennedys wanted to act all of a sudden. But Robert Williams had begun to train the people in his community, and they developed what is referred to now as gun clubs, and especially the women, because the men at point in times would be gone away from the house during the day trying to make a honest buck to take care of their families. And due to his militancy, Robert Williams came under attack, as he had become the chairperson of the local NAACP in his neck of the woods. And it was these, it was the Negro intellectuals who had a problem with Robert Williams's militancy. And Robert Williams had time and again had expressed that the Europeans there had bombs, and they were firebombing black people's houses. And so therefore, Robert Williams had developed the concept of self-defense and armed self-defense, that, again, the best way to fight fire is with water, and you cannot possibly meet brute force with Gandhiism, which was the contradiction on the part of Malcolm X, on the part of Martin Luther King. It was a clear and outright shortcoming. It was a clear and outright mistake, a costly one, to try to get the collective masses of black people to embrace nonviolent strategy whenever violence was being practiced against innocent black people who had always been the victims of that violence, same violence that their ancestors had went through by being forcefully taken by the force of violence from the continent of Africa and brought here in the same violence that was heaped upon them to perform their slavery task and build the economic capitalist infrastructure of this country. And so they had only become the inheritors of violent attack. And Robert Williams had clearly understood, by being a war vet, that out in the battlefield, in the war theater, that passivity would get you killed in the theater of war. When you have an enemy who has the mentality, the psychology of annihilating your side, your army, seeing you as his enemy. And so this is what Robert Williams had begun to get the people in his neck of the woods to understand. In the meantime, the NAACP leadership, the SCLC leadership, the National Urban League, or the Urban League under Whitney Young, Congress, the Racial Equality, headed by Roy Ennis, and of course, the organization referred to as SNCC, started out as a student nonviolent coordinating committee, from which came the great H. Rap Brown and the great Stokely Carmichael, who gave us, who popularized the slogan, rather, of Black Power. And also a lesser known figure who went by the name of Willie Ricks, the man who inaugurated put the two terms together, black and power, because he clearly understood that it was about power, that no measure of civil rights could outstrip the power. There's an old saying on the part of the ancestor, the forefather, or the progenitor of the Rothschild family, Maya Amschel Bauer, who had stated, who is known to have said that, give me the power of one's currency, and I care not who makes his laws. And not only did he realize that, but he, as a theory, he put it into practice. And so this is the type of understanding that Willie Ricks at the time had began to proselytize, if you will, among the people in the South. In Lowndes County, Stokely Carmichael and the other individuals who were there working in the communities, organizing the people to at least have some representation, since they were taxpayers, someone on the local level who looked like them in office. And as a result of that, registering the people to vote, educating the people, politicizing them. They had gotten around to a slogan, to a logo, to a name. And that became known as the Black Panthers. And the logo of the Black Panther was drawn up and became their logo for their voting organization. And this is how the Black Panther Party was initially given birth, and coupled with Robert Williams' self-defense, the great Huey P. Newton, who at the time was a student at Merritt College, had began to take notice and had began to observe and pay careful close attention to all the different organizations that profess to care about the welfares of African people. And the ones that impressed them the most were SNCC and Robert Williams. So Huey P. Newton had developed his ideology, and of course, Marcus Garvey's self-help termination, which is what the community control was about. And the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense as a Black Nationalist Organization was given birth to in 1966 in Oakland, California. And in the midst of that, you still had the civil rights leaders steadily trying to gain these amenities, these relief efforts, such as equal rights in local government or what have you, jobs, which became the bulwark of the civil rights movement. Of course, the legislation that was passed in the administration of Pig Johnson, who had knowledge, and of course, a lot of people know that John F. Kennedy wasn't just assassinated by some Russian KGB agent or affiliate. Okay, but it is this brand of the movement that had to be put down, that had to be squashed. At some point in time, the state would have had to make a decision due to the portfolio that it was facing, whether or not they would choose this ideology or that ideology. And this is how the civil rights leadership was shaped. And, of course, the financial support by the rich white families, and particularly the Rockefellers, these concessions that were handed out. The continuance or the advancement of the Black entrepreneurial spirit, which was spearheaded by the Rockefeller family. Now, if we go back to the evolution of this Black entrepreneurial spirit, we can even go back as far back as the days preceding the ending of physical slavery, where there was a small, tiny, tiny sector of so-called free Negroes who were able to achieve some type of collegiate success and went on to create some type of capital. And, of course, the most notable would be Madam C.J. Walker. Of course, you know, with the hair, the curl and the hot iron or whatever you want to call it. Okay, and the, you know, how she was able to accumulate wealth that way. And so on the heels of Reconstruction or physical slavery, there was a change in ideology, whereas before the blacks didn't these few blacks didn't have to depend on blacks per se. It was only after when physical slavery was struck down that the whites who had been so friendly had turned on them due to the conditions that had become of the ending of physical slavery. And so these black entrepreneurs were in jeopardy. And so they had developed a strategy, an ideology, a party line, a pickup line, just the same way as McDonald's has one, Sprite, and all the rest of the corporations that sell products. Some type of like jingle. Yeah, what you got, Conrad? We got the callers?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. We can let him in, Conrad. Who we got, Conrad?
Black Power 346. You're live.
Black Power. Black Power. Brother Katil Sadiq. What's going on, Conrad? Yuhuru. Black Power.
Yuhuru, Conrad. Right on.
Black Power. What's going on, family? Black Power. I've been listening to what National Chairman Brother Nat Turner has been talking about here tonight, and all the information is so great. It's so great. So I just wanted to come in and drop a little something off to keep the conversation hot. You know what I'm saying? So I'll jump right into this thing, and we can discuss it as we go on with the different shows, right? So I just want to jump into this thing. I want to recommend a book first. Dr. E.P. Newton's Revolutionary Suicide. That's a book that I feel like every revolutionary should have, and especially those that are in their third mind searching for black nationalism. Dr. E.P. Newton's Revolutionary Suicide is a great book. On page 125, Dr. E.P. Newton, he reads, when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth, to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitled them. Dr. E.P. Newton said, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to separation. And one of the causes for separation that I, you know, can think of in my head, you know, as I'm analyzing this information, is genocide and ethnic cleansing. You know, and genocide and ethnic cleansing, those two words hold so much weight in the political atmosphere that I want to just give a quick definition on genocide and ethnic cleansing as is stated in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. And again, this is information we can discuss throughout the shows, right? So the United Nations defines genocide as a deliberate killing of a large number of people from a particular nation or ethnic group with the aim of destroying that nation or group. They list in the Rome Statute of International Criminal Court, they list different aspects of genocide. The first is killing members of the group. The second is causing seriously bodily or mental harm to the group. The third is deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about their physical destruction in whole or in part. The second to last point is imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group population control. And then, of course, the final would be forcefully transferring children of the group to another group. It goes on further in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court on Article 7 to begin to break down different aspects of genocide. One of those aspects is crimes against humanity. Again, crimes against humanity. And it reads quickly, for the purpose of this statute, crimes against humanity means any of the following acts when committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack directed against any civilian population with knowledge of the attack. This includes murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation or forceful transfer of population, imprisonment or other severe deprivation of physical liberty in violation of fundamental rules of international law, torture, rape, sexual slavery, enforced prostitution, forced pregnancy, enforced sterilization, or any other form of sexual violence. Finally, I would like to end this note before turning it back over to our host. I want to talk about the mental element of genocide. which is something that is not as talked about or as understood as it could be. The mental element, according to Article 7 of the Rome Statute in the International Criminal Court, with the knowledge of the attack, the mental element or the contextual element determines that crimes against humanity involve either large-scale violence in relation to the number of victims or its extension over a broad geographic area, or also that could be called widespread, or acts of violence. In addition, Article 7.2 of the Rome Statute determines that crimes against humanity must be committed in furtherance of a state or organizational policy to commit an attack. The plan or policy does not need to be explicitly stipulated or formally adopted and can therefore be inferred from the totality of the circumstances. And I'll end there. And what I'll say, wrapping those points up, is the reason why I bring genocide and ethnic cleansing to the forefront, coming off the heels of page 125 of Revolutionary Warfare by Dr. Huey P. Newton, is because those that crime, genocide, and the crimes thereof in genocide are more than enough reason that impel us as a people to separate, right? So I end on the basis of separation, genocide, and crimes against humanity. And I'll stop there and I'll say Ashe, Black Power, and Yahoo. Black Power, Brother Nat.
Right on, brother. That's what's up. Yeah, man, that's right on time. Look, and yeah, you know, we spoke earlier. We're gonna definitely get more into that, because that was a thing, you know, that Malcolm X was trying to get us to understand. You know, Malcolm X had done what the others either hadn't gotten around to, or they were hesitant to get involved with, was internationalizing our struggle, was internationalizing the condition, popularizing the material conditions of black people in this country. And while America was parading itself around the world as a democracy, having the gall and the audacity to want to take a look at Korea and Vietnam, while at the same time even their compadres in South Africa, you know, how they were claiming Vietnam wasn't right, yet they turned a blind eye to what their Dutch and British compadres had been doing in South Africa. And the old adage about the majority rules, their white brethren in South Africa had proven that to be a contradiction by the simple fact that they were in control of the power, and the power of the purse also comes with having the reins to a military force, brute force, you know, access to many weapons of mass destruction. You know, but that was the thing that Malcolm X had so brilliantly began to exercise. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, can be under the impression, you know, that Malcolm X, you know, had been assassinated because, you know, he called the white man the devil and all these other things. But when you take a look at it, Malcolm X was clearly on the international scene, and that America, the countries that Malcolm had selectively visited were the same countries that America was dependent on for natural resources. So America had to, you know, go in, spring into action through its CIA apparatus, its international arm of the state, to derail Malcolm X's ability to galvanize the international court of opinion against America. And his plans to take it to the UN were cut short. In the meantime, Martin Luther King had finally come around and realized that his Gandhiism philosophy was flawed. And I think a lot of people, of course, you know, coming up as a child, you know, you've internalized Martin Luther King more than any other black leader. You've internalized Martin Luther King so much that you've yet to realize that this country itself has its own political prisoners. You know, Matula Shakur, you know, is his own political prisoners. You know, even among the so-called Native American people of North America, Leonard Peltier, you know, who's still being held as a political prisoner. AIM, the American Indian Movement, which suffered the same fate that the Black Panther Party had been subjected to through the counterintelligence program. You see, and the common struggle, the common masses of the people who are being held under the rule of thumb by the white capitalists. You see, and particularly black and brown people, not only in America but around the world. So this is what made Malcolm X the threat that he was. Even Robert Williams, who had had to flee the country, you know, who having espoused revolutionary change, adapting Mao Zedong's freedom comes through the barrel of a shotgun. You see, and so he had to flee the country, and he was whisked away to Cuba. And Mao Zedong received him. And due to that, America was looking what appeared to be the writing on the wall. And just one black man, and this same black man had become a hero in the eyes of the black American public, so much so that a rally that was planned in New York featuring these so-called black leaders who would speak. And one of these so-called Negro leaders or black leaders is Whitney Young. And Whitney Young was on the stage speaking to the crowd. And the people began to boo Whitney Young because they had had enough of that shit. And so they demanded that Robert Williams speak. They wanted to hear Robert Williams speak. And so these are the type of advances that had been made. And these are the things that you may not necessarily receive in the classroom, even so-called black studies on the HBCU campuses. Now, that's no attack or no slight. It is what it is, you see. But People's Political Party, in defense of the People Radio, will try to take up what's not being disseminated to the people to the best of our ability, even though it may be limited. But it was because of Robert Williams that the people had begun to understand where the real ball was. And so Robert Williams was making his way to speak on the stage. And Whitney Young is said to have whispered in Robert Williams' ear before he got on stage, so much just basically that he told Robert Williams that he didn't want no shit out of him. You see, this is the problem. Why would one black man tell another black man who claims to be fighting for the same thing as this black man tell him he don't want any shit out of him? And one can only answer that question by the simple fact that the unseen forces that had been behind the Urban League had set the tone for the type of struggle, and particularly the ideology that was supposed to be forced on to the people. And this is what Robert Williams had went beyond. And he had come under attack, even by Martin Luther King. And it is said that when Martin Luther King had visited Robert Williams' neck of the woods, and that a brother was sent to either check on Dr. King or bring him a message. And that when he had gotten to the house that King had been staying at, and he said that Martin Luther King was a hypocrite for criticizing Robert Williams for the imagery of guns, and that Martin Luther King had a guard on that corner, this corner, and that corner, and that corner, and they were all holding shotguns. And when he got inside the house, he had an arsenal inside. And so young people cannot make sense of that unless they able to think critically and look at it from another angle. When Nelson Rockefeller, as I mentioned earlier, you know, in his campaign for his presidency bid, he traveled on a train, you know, and little did people understand or little did people know that, you know, one or two occasions, several occasions, he had also had somebody accompanying him on that train. You see? And it was Martin Luther King. When Martin Luther King was an attempt on his life or stabbed or whatever, he had, of course, had been taken to the hospital. Word is that Nelson Rockefeller contacted the facility and told them, you know, handle your business, send me the bill. You know, these are the type of things that are heart-wrenching to some people. But it is what it is. You know, Malcolm X came from the streets. You know, a lot of people attacked Malcolm after he left the nation and said that Malcolm had abandoned black power and black nationalism, you know, which is no such thing. He had expanded his thought process on the international level, on the international stage, just as the Black Panther Party had expanded its thought process on an international level. Yet it still understood and advocated for black power. And black power was just simply the same thing that white Jewish people had been doing, the same thing that the Arab population is doing today when the British and the European imperialists came for the oil and what has been carved out as the Middle East. The Arabs realized that they were forced into a situation to where they had to huddle up and develop a staunch style of nationalism, which became known as Arab nationalism. By the way, comrade, do we have any more callers? Can you hear me? 1-2-1-2. Can y'all hear me? Okay, well, it appears to be that we're having some technical difficulties. If you can hear me, my point was that other groups, other nations, other tribes that have come under the same form of European aggression, you know, it's only a natural thing that they would resort to some type of self-preservation, nationhood, tribal preservation, whatever you want to call it. You understand what I'm saying? And so that was the whole point, you know, of developing a platform when Malcolm X had come back, you know, Afro-American unity. You know, something that he had gotten from the African Union when he was in Africa. You see? And, you know, so it was only natural that that would take place. And, of course, in the meantime, again, you know, the civil rights leadership began to realize, you know, that the jig was up. And so assassination of King, of course, there's a great ramifications there, you know, even conspiratorial on the part of one or two individuals in the civil rights leadership, you know, that some have pointed to Jesse Jackson, even Reverend Billy Kyle. Okay, years ago, in more modern times, Reverend Billy Cowles was at a function, and he was speaking about Martin Luther King and the type of man he was, and, you know, who Martin Luther King was, all the way up to the point of the day of his assassination, how they were up on the balcony, and Jesse Jackson was down on the ground in the parking lot. And out of his own mouth, you know, the elders believe that, you know, every someone so, you know, God makes people, you know, those who have done wrong or had some part in something, and, you know, the guilt and you know, God makes them slip up every now and again. Well, it was Billy Kyle's turn, and Billy Kyle's had spoken to that audience. And out of his own mouth, and he used, you know, his forefinger sticks, you know, to show, like, you know, their standing arrangement or, you know, this, that, and the other. And Billy Kaiser simply explains, whereas I was standing here and Dr. King was standing next to me, and I moved over, you know, so they can get a good shot. That's when the shot rang out, out of his own mouth, you know. And Jesse Jackson is on the ground pointing, but some people feel in the wrong direction. And when he had come up upstairs, it was Andrew Young who was near King's body, like, you know, someone holding, you know, a loved one or, you know, right near him. And Jesse Jackson had to step over him, you know, to get the King's body. Okay, and out of Andrew Young's own mouth, he had said that as he was wailing and he was, you know, but he noticed that Jesse Jackson had reached over him and put his hand in King's blood and wiped it on his shirt. And then when the media came, Jesse Jackson is informing, you know, before they came, he's informing everybody, nobody speaks to the media and whatnot. But when the media comes, and there's video footage of this, there's video footage of it, okay? The ambulance come, all these people come, what have you, whatnot, and you see these, you know, everybody's, you know, getting into some type of vehicle, you know, the entourage is going to the hospital where they're taking King, and Jesse Jackson is the only one who somehow some kind of way gets left behind. He's standing there, he's just adding up. And you can hear him asking whatever, something about a ride. And say, well, how did you get left behind? And so the reporter, when asked Jesse Jackson how to get the blood on his shirt, it gave a different story, that he was holding Dr. King in his arms. But Andrew Young said that Jesse Jackson reached over him and put his hand in King's blood and wiped it on his shirt. So there's some betrayal there or evidence of it, you see. However far people want to take this, you know. But King had given this speech about the war in Vietnam. And according to Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, he had called him, and King called him and informed him that he wanted him front row, front and center at the church because he's going to give this speech about the Vietnam War. And Stokely Carmichael took that as, this is King's coming out, out from underneath, you know, this thing for the longest that Bayard Rustin had filled in him. And he had gave this speech about Vietnam, you see. And then if America could, in so many words, you know, be over there claiming democracy, this, that, and fight for, and then it's got its own people here, its own since black people. And this, in the audio of Andrew Johnson, I mean, of President Lyndon Baines Johnson, is an audio. He's either talking to Kissinger or his defense minister. And some believe it's Kissinger that he's talking to. And in the audio, he's clearly saying that he felt that Dr. King had betrayed him, had stabbed him in the back after all what I've done for the man. And that march across that James Pettus Bridge, the first one where they got the shit beat out of them, and particularly Ralph Abernathy, that's the one that King wasn't at. The second one that everybody's pretty much aware of, where he is part of that, and they marched across that bridge. And it is said that Johnson had gotten a call and asked for a victory. And that victory was that march across that bridge. And that is what Johnson was referring to. Well, he said that he felt that the man had betrayed him after all I had done for the man. And that was the writing on the wall. And his meeting with Malcolm X. You know, and this supposedly future getting together again, you see. And so this transformation of King's ideology, and to the point where some today declare that King had become revolutionary, which I think is a stretch, you know. But as I said earlier, the highest type of black man in this country due to material conditions is revolutionary, you see. And so we're going to end it with that. And a part three, which will be Tuesday, and will take us into our own modern times. And, you know, yeah, it's going to get funky, you know. And so we want to thank those who have been listening and tune in same time, same black time, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, to In Defense of the People's Radio. And I'm your host, Chairman Nat Turner. And also my co-host, my Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland, on the ones and twos tonight. And so, Brother, if you can take us out,
Black Power,
give us something good. And that's what we say, Black Power and Uhuru and all power to the people.
And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like. Look, the only reason I survive, cause a nigga is special first. You get successful, then they get stressful thirst. Niggas gon' test you, see what your texture's worth. Diamonds and pipes, one of them pressure burst. Street niggas, still I get checked first. I'm for peace, but before I get pressed, I murk. Better days, pray for, but expecting worse. At this level, bullshit, I'm just less concerned. Cruising in the six, looking at the proceeds of rap music on my wrist. Drop another mixtape, my shit booming out this bitch. Young Malcolm, I'm the leader of the movement out this bitch. Look, and this is what it feels like.
Reach a level, make you question, is it real life? All the weed good, all the pussy real tight. In the only room, keep your dollar bills and right. What it feels like. And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like. What it feels like.
Scorpion bricks, way before Orbeez double disc. 40 on my lap, clap, sound like 40 did the mix. Filtered bass, sip coat, like a Michelin star chef. Chef, kiss to my wrist, I go dummy with my left. I arrest on my dick, try to audit all my checks. Too late, you know they hate when you become more than they expect. You let them crack or storm your capital, put their feet up on your desk. And yeah, you talking tough to me, I lost all my little respect. I'm selling weed in the open, bringing folks home from the feds. I know the payback gon' be mean, I'm saving all my little bread. Pray for me, y'all, one day I'ma have to pay for these thoughts. Real niggas is distinct, it ain't safe for me. My dog, they killing niggas in their own hood. That makes sense to you at all? You burnt your bridge to the other side, you know you can't swim across. Y'all know niggas can't swim, they fried Mike after he died. Y'all know niggas can't win, you never land, don't joke aside. I arrived on the day Fred Hampton got murdered. Hold up. Assassinated, just to clarify further. What y'all gave birth is the chairman mixed with Jeff Ford. Big step on the jet with my legs crossed. Black stones on my neck, y'all can't kill Christ. Black Messiah is what I feel like. Shit ain't gonna stop cause y'all spill blood. We gon' turn up even more since y'all killed
cubs. And this is what it feels like. This is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, to whom all praise is due, whom we forever thank for giving us the Honorable Elijah Muhammad as our leader, teacher, and guide. And I specifically, ladies and gentlemen, and brothers and sisters, open up like that because I am a representative of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And were it not for him, you and I wouldn't be here today. In order for you and me to devise some kind of method or strategy to offset some of the events or a repetition of the events that have taken place here in Los Angeles recently, we have to go to the root. We have to go to the cause. Dealing with the condition itself is not enough. We have to get to the cause of it all, or the root of it all. And it is because of our effort toward getting straight to the root that people oftentimes think we are dealing in hate. But first, I would like to congratulate and give praise to the Negro, so-called Negro leaders and so-called Negro organizations. And excuse me if I say so-called, it's hard for me to just outright say Negro when I know what that word Negro really means. The person whom you have come to know as Ronald Stokes, we know him as Brother Ronald, one of the most religious persons who displayed the highest form of morals of any black person anywhere on this earth. And as one of the previous speakers pointed out who knew him, everyone who knew him had to give him credit for being a good man, a clean man, an intelligent man, and an innocent man when he was murdered. The Negro, so-called Negro organizations and leaders should be given great credit for their failure or refusal to let the white man divide them and use them one against the other.